close of the Old Testament
and the opening of the New Testament. Now, in general, I kind of hope, went ahead and planned to do it this time because with Marshall covering Ezra and Nehemiah, that's going to be a really great coverage of that time period as they were coming back from captivity. And we'll see how all that fits in a second here. But Malachi is the prophet that we'll be looking at probably, not next week, week after, as the close of the Old Testament period and some of the things that he was looking at. And then you go forward and you say, when we New Testament, in terms of the prophecies that were predicted, the things that were going to happen that would begin the New Testament age, it really starts with John the Baptist. And that's really kind of a neat framing there because you have this prophecy in Malachi at the close of the coming of Elijah and then Jesus saying that John the Baptist was the Elijah of Malachi. So that's the time period. Now, where does that all fit in history? Well, if we look at the overall timeline, and you're going to see slight differences in some of the dates on some of the slides and things. Pay no attention to anything that, you know, rounds up or down by a few years. There's some of these that are just close, right? So we really can't tell much about recorded history in the Bible until we get to the patriarchal age. Prior to that in Genesis, it's speculation for how many years there are and all that kind of thing. You know, we've had people try to put dates and times and things. We're going to leave that alone. But when you think about the writing of the Old Testament, where does that really start? Starts with Moses, right? That's where we begin with the written history. Because it was Moses who had his training in Egypt, who was coming out and was going to give the law. He started with the patriarchs. And we know that a lot of that history was oral history, and it was, you know, maintained by the people through these various periods. But we start out with patriarchs and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, all the way down to going into Egypt. And we've got a couple hundred year period there. And then there's the 400 years in Egypt, and that's all documented in Exodus, as we look at the side of kind of the silent years there too, right? We start with them going in, and then we pick up with them going out. And then in between, we've got historical references for some of the pharaohs and things like that that happen, but we don't know a lot about the generations during that time period other than they grew from a very small family into a nation. And that's when the nation was developed, was in the land of Egypt in terms of the people and the population. But this was a nation without a country. And if we go back to those promises in Genesis, he said that he was going to give them three things. What was it? The first thing was land. They didn't have that quite yet. He would make of them a great nation, right? And then through them all the nations of the earth would be blessed. So in looking at those things, they came out of Egypt. They went in the period of the judges, and I just put that whole period there, even though really Joshua is the one who goes in and conquers the land and gets things set up. During that period, if you think about empire and you think about world history and those kinds of things, if you read about the judges and that period in history, would you really have called that anything like a unified nation from the way the world looks at history? And in fact, even if you read the archaeologists and the people who are looking at that in their time period, they consider it a tribal time period. And that's really what it was. And you had the tribes and their lands and there really wasn't a central government. So they weren't quite in what you would call a nation state yet, although God had given them the land. Where did the nation really start? Okay, they demanded a king. Who was the first king? Saul. Okay, so he kind of got it started, but things didn't go real well with Saul, right? So as Marshall mentioned this morning, we had established this nation. David was the one who kind of finished fighting for it. It comes to its real zenith under Solomon with the wealth and everything that's there for those temples. And, building of the temple under Solomon. And now they really were looking like this great country. You know, they had a wise king and everybody's coming to them. And how long did that last? Till Solomon died. Okay, and then you got the split, Jeroboam, Rehoboam, and now it's kind of downhill for a while. But you still got some ups and downs, and you've got this period of the kings where you get people trying to do what's right in the south. North never really did try again. Although, you know, there were, you know, when you start reading about it and you read about, like, Jehu when he comes in, don't you have a little hope there when he comes in and he knocks out all the idols and, you know, just kills all the Baal worshippers? And if you were reading this with sort of blinders on for the first time, you might be thinking, ooh, there's some hope for this country. And then it all gets dashed again. And so these people, as they look over their own history and their ups and downs, and you think about what Moses had promised would be theirs if they obeyed God. And it seems like there's always at least a small group of people. There's always the thing that we call the remnant, right? The remnant wasn't just once. There was a lot of times when there was just a small group of people who were being willing to be faithful and to serve God. And they're always looking forward to those promises, looking forward to the things that they might be able to enjoy as this, you know, a great nation under God, having God as their sovereign. And it just seems like things always get in the way. And so we come to the close of that period when, in around 606, 605, whatever you want to call the date there, the last of the kings in Judah is done away with. And we have the Babylonians coming over and conquering that area. Now, there's a couple of kings appointed after that and things, but they're under Babylon, right? And they try to revolt. Who gets carried away into captivity during 605? There's three time periods. We mentioned those this morning, but I always like to remember the prophets that went along with them. Because the first one, in 605, who gets hauled off? Daniel, right? And that's, we're going to talk about that in just a minute, because this is the period of captivity they're coming into, and it's an important one. So then you got about 597 or 596, come back again, because they're trying to revolt again. And who gets carried off that time? Ezekiel. Okay? And then who do you associate as a prophet with the final one in 586? Jeremiah. Okay? So those three have a lot to do with this whole sort of shutting down of the old period, of the kings and that time frame. And they go into this 70 years of captivity. Now, one of the reasons I also want to study this time period and the silence as we get there is I think it's helpful if you try to put yourself in the frame of mind of someone who was a Jew in whatever time period you're looking at and say, what would have been their position if they were trying to be a faithful Jew? What would they be looking for? How would their life be structured? What would they want for the future? And during this period of captivity, there was something really, really major missing in their lives for 70 years. Yeah, the temple worship, the times that they were supposed to go to Jerusalem, all of the things that were just central to the worship of Jehovah God were gone. And yet, they could maintain their faith in God, could they not? And we see Daniel is a great example of that. Even when he couldn't fulfill some of the things, he was always looking forward to the end of that captivity and of a return. And then you get to the end of Daniel, and he says, it's time, and we're going to go back. And what we're going to look here is starting kind of in that period just a little bit, and then kind of concentrating on that 400 years. But I want to just look at a couple of things here real quickly. And Marshall's going to cover a lot of this more in detail. I just want to look at a couple of little highlights. We had Ezekiel who's prophesying in captivity. We have Daniel who has a lot of prophecies. And then we come to the year about 536 when Zerubbabel takes up the banner and under a decree from Cyrus says, we're going to go back and we're going to start this up again. What are they looking for? What do they want? We talked about it a little bit this morning. What do they want? Go ahead. That's fine. Go ahead. Okay. They're wanting to renew the kingdom. So there's multiple pieces of this. They want their land back, right? And they want to get set back up again. Did they really want to be a Persian lackey? Not really. Not really. Now, to Zerubbabel's credit, you know, he's going to be follow the orders and do what he needs to do and get it set up there. But what's the big thing that he's got in mind that they're going to get started on here when they get back there? What was his major job? Yeah, let's get the temple started again. And I really think there's a couple of passages. Marshall mentioned one of them this morning, but when you look at some of the prophecies that are during this time period, one of the things is the restoration of the temple. We looked at Ezekiel, the 10th chapter, when that presence of God was going away. But towards the end of Ezekiel, he has a lot of prophecies concerning this new temple. And he has prophecies, for example, if you go over to Ezekiel, the 43rd chapter, Ezekiel 43, you see that there's a coming back. He's been measuring the city and measuring this new temple and all of these kinds of things. And it says then that he led me to the gate facing towards the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the way of the east. Now that's where it went off to. And now it's coming back. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. And the earth shone with his glory. And it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision when I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell on my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate facing towards the east. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. So Ezekiel sees the glory of the Lord leaving. He is prophesying his first part before the destruction of Jerusalem. But then it falls. And now he's looking for the future. But these people coming back from captivity, they're thinking, is this part of Ezekiel? Are we there yet? And you know, it had to be a little difficult on them. If you look over in the book of Ezra in the 3rd chapter, when they go back and they're rebuilding this temple, they lay the foundations. Most people will be familiar with this passage, but in Ezra 3, beginning of verse 10, it says, "Now when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord according to the directions of King David of Israel. And they sang, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, saying, for he is good, for his loving kindness is upon Israel forever. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Yet many of the priests and Levites and heads of the fathers' households, the old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, while many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the shout of joy from the sound of the weeping of the people. For people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard far away." When I think about that, and this great gathering that they had, they didn't even have the second temple built yet. What was there? It was just the foundation. Okay? Now, a lot of times, any of you ever been involved in building a new house? And the first thing they do is they, you know, start digging up the ground, digging up dirt and everything. They lay all these boards around, and then, you know, in most of our cases, they just start pouring concrete. This wasn't a concrete foundation, probably. It was hewn stones and all that kind of stuff. So it's still a lot of work to get this thing laid out. And can you tell a lot about a building from the foundation? Yeah, you have to be pretty good at your imagination, right? Because it's just the foundation. But you can say, you know, over here's where the front door is going to be, and this is going to be the back room, and Over there is going to be the comfy chair when we ever get that part finished. And so people would have been looking at that. But I think one of the things they would have had in their mind are some of these prophecies of Ezekiel. And if you read through those prophecies about the coming temple, you think that foundation looked a lot like what Ezekiel had described? Not really. Not really. And according to some of the ones who had seen the old temple, what was their response when they looked at the foundations for the new one? It's not going to be like the old days, is it? And so even though that's what they were looking forward to, it was a discouraging and it was a hard time. And as you look on it, they finally had Haggai and Zechariah get in there several years later. I mean, it sat there for 15, 16 years, didn't do anything. And they finally got up and got the whole thing built. And then things start falling apart again. And it's not until you get down to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah that they're really trying to get things together. Now, one of the things that you'll find in the book of Nehemiah is that Nehemiah was the governor there for some period of time. He was essentially appointed, you know, by the king to go back there and be the governor there. Ezra was in charge of the religious restructuring at that time. And Nehemiah had to go back home and report for a while. And it's probably during that time period that we find the prophet Malachi. Now, Malachi is as the last book. If you go and look at Malachi 1 and verse 1, it says the oracle or burden of Malachi. That's the only place we find his name. There are some people who think that's like a title and not really a prophet's name, but on the other hand, it's short for the messenger of God. Malachi by itself means my messenger. And he's got some things to say, and we'll start talking about those more next week, about what's going wrong. And we'll look at that to say, what's happening? What's going wrong during that time that things are going to kind of shut down here for a good while? Now, if you look at that sheet that I handed out, were there enough for everybody? We'll get some other things as you go on, but this one was a nice one I found that kind of has a breakdown of some of the periods. They're under Persian rule during this time period, but one of the things you'll notice is that that doesn't last all that much longer. There's an interesting fellow who comes along. Anybody remember his name? Alexander the Great, right? The Persian days were numbered even while this restoration from captivity is going on. And Alexander the Great is going to push Greece and the Greek culture throughout the world. That was the way he figured he could unify the world, was to spread Greek culture. And that's not yogurt culture. That's things like their language and their paintings and their philosophies and all that kind of stuff. And that's where we hit, if we go back to this period down here, that's the period of silence. Why do people call it the 400 years of silence? Ironsides wrote a book called The 400 Silent Years. Okay, we don't have any canonical writings, the ones that were inspired by God, written during that time period. We close at Malachi, we pick up at Matthew, got a gap. There's an interesting thing, though, folks. This was not a silent period. There is a lot of history that occurred during this time period and a lot of things that we know about, and it's well documented. And there's also some interesting things going on in Canaan during that time period. Some people, you probably have heard of the Maccabees. That's probably one of the famous ones. One of the things there, for example, is and we'll talk more about it when we get to the Maccabees, but they were under one of the other rulers. Let's start at the top, we'll work down and get there in a second. Got ahead of myself. So, we got Alexander the Great who comes along, and great general, marches through, conquers the world, great kingdom, and then what does he do? He died at a very young age. He had four generals, and he had no heirs. And so guess who's fighting to take over this new great vast empire? Four generals. Now, the two of them that kind of have the legacies that we'll be talking about some are the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, right? And so, right after Alexander the Great kind of falls apart, the Ptolemies, who were more down in Egypt, are the ones who controlled Canaan. And so, during that time period, they kind of switched from being a vassal of Persia to very shortly being a vassal of Alexander the Great, and then all of a sudden, they're under the Ptolemies. Well, the Seleucids, who are up in the north, kind of the Syria side of things, they can't let that stand, and eventually they wrest control of that area from the Ptolemies. And you've probably heard of Antiochus Epiphanes, we'll talk more about him, but there was a whole line of Antiochus folks, and they were the Seleucids. They weren't real keen on Judaism. Okay, the Ptolemies kind of let things go, but life was kind of tough in Jerusalem during that time. They really were suffering a lot. Absolutely. If you got the Seleucids to the north and you got the Ptolemies in the south, where do they fight? Right in the middle, which is where Canaan was located. So it was battles, and they were either getting conscripted into one side's army or the other. It was just a really rough time for these folks. But when the Seleucids came down, they really didn't like Judaism. And this is one of the key areas where they desecrated the temple. They were trying to destroy the law. They burned as many copies of the old law as they could find. And finally, it was the Maccabees who decided, we've had enough of this. We're going to throw the bums out. And they actually succeeded in doing that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that history and whatnot. But for example, and in the book of the Maccabees, there is a description of the rededication of the temple. And one of the problems that they had was that they didn't have enough of the right kind of olive oil that they were supposed to burn in the lamps. Okay, this had to be, you know, first press. There were all kinds of rules and regulations about this, and they found one bottle left. And that was enough for one day. Now, it was going to take them 8 days to prepare the next batch. And guess what is recorded during the time period that happened? It says that the oil continued to burn instead of just one day for 8 days. Now, when you think about that for a minute, there's a question. Could it have done that? Could it have done that? Certainly. Could have. We don't really know one way or the other exactly what all went on there. And since we don't have a writing that we know is inspired that can tell us a story, we can't say for certain. But I will say that they started a new feast and festival associated with that. What's that called? Festival of Lights, or Hanukkah. And that's where, in symbolic of that time, they have a 9-branch menorah. The center branch is lit, and then there's the other 8 that are representative of the 8 days that the oil burned. But it's also called the Feast of Dedication. And in John, the 10th chapter, you'll find that Jesus went to Jerusalem during one of the Feasts of Dedication. So he celebrated that occurrence with the folks there too. We'll find out in the after while. But it is quite possible that since they were trying to do what was right, that God granted them a miracle then. It would not be out of character for Old Testament time period. So it's possible. But the point there is, we had people trying to do what was right, and when the Maccabees were trying to rededicate the temple, I think they had in mind, we'd like to get back to what we'd lost. We'd like to get our land back. We'd like to get our nation back. We'd like to get our temple back and work towards that. But you know what? Even that didn't last too long. And pretty soon, they're falling apart. And who's the next one that comes in after they finally kind of get the Seleucids out? It's the Romans. So we have the Romans coming in. Now, if you look at the timeline, the Romans then take us all the way up to the time of Christ. And they were in charge when Christ was born. There are a lot of prophecies in the Old Testament And we will look at some of these in Daniel as part of the class. Daniel wrote in between chapters 7 and 11 a lot of prophecies concerning this time period. Some of it very detailed on some of the things that were going to go on. And we're not going to go through all of those as I would if I were doing a study of Daniel, but I do want to point out some of them as in one of the classes, or two of the classes, we'll see how long it takes us, and show how it lines up with history as that being one of the things it was talking about. So here's some stuff that was given to the people as prophecy that they could see unfolding as these events take place. Now, whether or not they recognized all of it, it's hard to say, but there were certainly parts of it that they did. And another prophecy was in Ezekiel. There's a very detailed prophecy about the fall of Tyre. Well, guess who it was that was instrumental in taking Tyre? Well, that was Alexander the Great. That was under the Greek time period. So it's not like we don't know anything about this from biblical history, from inspired history. We've got a lot of prophecies that said what was going to go on there. And those things all came to pass. Yes.
And you know, showed them that, hey, you were fulfilling these prophecies. And they could track it. And that's why, of course, when you get to the time of John the Baptist and Matthew, they were in that same invitation. They knew the time was there.
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of what we want to get out of this study, is as we look through that time period, when we've closed at Malachi and we open up Matthew, it's easy for us to go, oh, and then it started, you know, and there was the expectation. It's 400 years, folks. Okay, how long has this nation been a country? 200-something, right? Okay, 1996 was the 200 years, so we're getting up at, 230 or 40 or whatever the math is there. That's half. Yeah, I'm not going to do the math on the fly. That'd just get me in trouble. We've only been around half the length of time that this period was located. And how many of us have firsthand knowledge of, you know, Washington crossing the Potomac, right? We know some of the stories. We read some of the history. Those folks would have been in the same condition. To them, the prophets of Malachi and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they would have been part of their cultural history. But they were looking at their time, saying, when's it going to come? When are we going to see this? When are we going to expect that God will favor us again? Because that's what they were looking for. So as we go on during that time, it turns out there are a lot of other writings, and you probably have heard of some of these, so we'll spend one or two classes on some of these. How many people have heard of the Apocrypha? Okay. So, good. If you were to open a Catholic printed Bible, you would find these books, typically right in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I have been asked on multiple occasions, why do some people accept them? Why do some people not accept them? And we'll go through some of that as we look at some of these. But as you look at it, there's several categories these things kind of fall into. There are some historical books there. We'll be looking at things like First Maccabees, which is reasonably decent as a history book, and Second Maccabees, which is reasonably interesting as a historical fantasy. And then some of the others, there's a teaching, the Wisdom of Solomon. Ecclesiasticus is an interesting book because it really isn't a book. Jerome collected a whole bunch of fragments and scattered stuff that he kind of glued together and called it additions, you know, that it should have been to some of the wisdom literature. We really don't even know that it was even close to the same authors. There's a couple of books that the only way I can categorize them is religious romance. That's about it. Then there's legendary. There's things where, you know, there's a couple of prophetic ones, and things that are legends, additions to Daniel and additions to Esther. And so we'll look at some of those, and when we do, give you a feel for why we do or don't accept these things. Where did they come from? Where did they first appear? Who was it that decided they were part of the canon and then they weren't part of the canon? So I think that's important for us to take a quick look at. The only book that we're going to spend a little bit of time in as far as The history part is the book of Maccabees, and we get to some of that historical setting. And so when you look at those things all together, it turns out that this 400 silent years isn't all that silent. And the things that went on there that affected these people's lives were part of the collective sort of consciousness that brought us up to the time of Christ. So when these people that are ready for the Messiah are looking at their past history, I don't know, if I were one of them looking at it, they were pretty downtrodden at the time of the Romans when this finally comes to fruition. And a lot of them have to be asking themselves, where is our God? Why won't he talk to us? Last brief hurrah we had was a couple hundred years ago with the Maccabees. How are we going to survive as a Jewish people without our God? Herod comes along as he starts breaking into that final period there, and he decides to rebuild the temple. And I think there's a lot of them that really looked at that. And if you look at some of the writings of Josephus and some of the others during that time period, of course, Josephus is a little later than Herod, but I mean, he's right on the cusp there, and that's modern history for them, that the expectations were finally, they get the temple, and things would get back to what they ought to be. And one of the things that Herod had as a goal, and got to remember, Herod's not exactly a religious person, right? Okay. Herod he's Roman to the core, and he's king over there simply at the whim of Rome. But he also knows Jewish history. And if you're going to get the group of people together there, what's one of the first things you really better have in place if you're going to have the people like you and favor you and come together? And that's the temple. And so he set out to make it magnificent. That was his goal, was to make a really, really pretty temple. Now, the people may have known that he wasn't exactly, you know, super Jewish religious at this point. But what were they wanting? They wanted their temple. And they wanted it to be the glory days again. And that's what a lot of them were looking to. Only that didn't work out real well, right? Yeah, yeah. You know, and there's a lot of that that we'll have to look at as you look at the expectations of people and what actually happened. I think the other thing we're going to find is that there was a wide range of expectations. You know, people had gone splintered enough that if you look at the writings in like the Mishnah and the Talmud about that time period, or even look at some of Josephus' writings about that time period, everybody had different ideas about what was going to happen and whether this Messiah was going to come or whether it was one Messiah or multiple Messiahs. And in AD 70, what happened to Herod's temple? That gets destroyed. Now, we might think that that's the end of Jewish history. And it sort of was, except, is there a Jewish people today? Yeah. And when they celebrate Passover every April, right around Easter time, right? They go through a very ritual ceremony, the Haggadah. And at the very end, there is a final blessing and saying, next year in Jerusalem. Why is that? What are they still looking for? They still want a temple. Because they think that if they can get their temple, that it'll all come back together. And that they'll finally get some of these things that they thought were theirs in the Old Testament promises. So we're going to look at that as we go through it. Because these hopes, these aspirations, these things that these people thought of, there are a lot of people still thinking that way today. And this land that they're trying to put together in Israel, there are even a lot of Christian groups, so-called Christian groups, who are expecting that someday Israel is going to rise again. And I think as we look at this period of silence and what goes on in there, we'll see how all that fits together.
Every president since Truman has affirmed Israel's ownership of that land, first deemed by God. Every president since Truman, at some point during the presidency, affirmed
Has Obama done that yet? Yeah. Well, and that just shows you how strong all of that influence is in that area. So I think as we look at this time period, hopefully we'll enjoy the study. Next week we're going to look at Malachi. Now, Marshall gave you the, not next week, but the week after. Marshall gave you the assignment of reading Ezra and Nehemiah. So you got 2 weeks now that you can also stick Malachi in there and read through Malachi, because I want to show how he kind of ended out the time with the problems that they were having, and then how those problems kind of carried over as we closed the Old Testament. Okay, that's the material that I had, and I'm actually a couple of minutes early this today. Anybody got any questions or other comments you want to make about this? I hadn't thought about that, but as I create them, if we want to put them on the webpage, we certainly can do that. That's not a problem. I'll get that done. I will have more handouts. I've got kind of a handout on the Apocrypha that I want to get, and I got a couple of more timelines and things. One of the things that I'm struggling with in this class is, as I've talked about today, I really want us to pay attention to the people and their thoughts and their aspirations and how it affected the way that they served and worshiped God, and how that moved them between the close of the old and the beginning of the new. But there's a lot of names and dates and history stuff in there too, and we've got to cover some of that, but I don't want this to sort of degenerate into just a names and dates class. We're going to cover some of the big names, and I'll hand you out papers that have some references and things if you're interested and want to read more of the details. And I would encourage you to do some reading on that, because some of it is interesting. If you can find the right books, and if you're interested, let me know. I'll recommend a few. But let's concentrate on how it fits the people. Because I think as we look at their reaction to their own history as it evolved, it helps us figure out how we live and what we should be looking forward to. And especially as it involves the people today and the state of Israel and those kinds of things, we'll have time to discuss all that, I think, as we go up. So we'll spend some time on Malachi, we'll spend some time on the Maccabees, we'll spend some time on the history stuff, and then we'll do just a little bit on the opening. Well, I think about the Dead Sea Scrolls, treasure trove, amazing treasure trove. But now I have to remember that the Dead Sea Scrolls were more than just Old Testament scrolls. There were a lot of Old Testament scrolls in there. The most famous one is the Isaiah scroll, this huge scroll, almost the entire book of Isaiah. That's phenomenal. But there were a lot of other writings as well, and a lot of those were intertestamental writings. Some of it was apocryphal stuff, not all of it. These apocryphal things were collected mostly during the Middle Ages, is when a lot of it came together. And we'll look at some dates on that. But we've got now a lot of writings. I've got an interesting book, I'll bring it in, that's the Jewish literature between Malachi and the Mishnah is the title of it. And a lot of it is based on things that they found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Just because it was a Dead Sea Scroll doesn't make it inspired. Okay? What it does is it gives us a view of history. And it gives us a view of that group of people and what they considered valuable, because the scrolls were what they were trying to hide and what they were trying to protect. So those were their valuable texts. And if you got other questions on them, I'll try to answer that. Mm-hmm.
Did the Jews have a written language?
They did. Writing was long before Moses. I mean, there's a lot of cuneiform writings all the way back into early Assyria. The Egyptians were fairly structured with their hieroglyphics. So there were a number of different writing forms. And the Code of Hammurabi, which predates the Law of Moses, I mean, that's all written out on the stones there. And you find these things like the Rosetta Stone, which was, really cool to see in the British Museum. There's this huge rock where they've done all these carvings, same thing in multiple languages, and that was the key to being able to interpret those things. And the thing I mentioned about Moses was, since he was the son of Pharaoh, he would have been well-educated. He was in a great position to actually be the one to author and to write a lot of this, obviously with the providence of God putting that in place.
Well, then, would the Ten Commandments have been written in Egyptian?
No, Hebrew. The Hebrews had their own language. They maintained a separate identity while they were in Egypt. And we can talk about separation a little bit, because one of the things that cultures don't survive unless there's some barrier, unless there's some separation. And when they were in Egypt, anybody remember where they settled? Land of Goshen, okay? And they settled there because that was part of the best of the land, but they also because they were shepherds, they were herdsmen, and those were abomination to the Egyptians, and so that created a cultural barrier between the Hebrews and the Egyptians. And later on, when they were enslaved, there was a second cultural barrier. When Daniel and those who were in exile, how did they maintain their identity? Okay, one of the ways was diet, right? Why did Daniel refuse the food and only take other certain things? It set him apart. And that was part of the Old Testament, was being set apart and having those boundaries there. And so that was, they would have had their own writing and Hebrew language. They spoke, there's a lot of different languages, Hebrew and Aramaic and others that are all scattered through there. But the Old Testament primarily was preserved in Hebrew. Anything else? All right. If you have anything specific that you'd like for me to cover during this time period, let me know. Talk to me, write me a note, whatever, and I'll work it in because, like I said, it's a little fluid right now. I got a lot that I want to cover, and we only have about 10 classes to do it in. And so I can adjust it if people have specific questions that they'd like to cover. But the first thing we're going to do is Malachi. So 2 weeks from now, we'll do Malachi.